Ahoy there, sailor. You're listening to Jewels and Bullets, the You and My Discography podcast, the show where a You and My fan and a You and My super fan discuss each of the band's records. I'm Tommy Waite, an Aussie writer and podcaster who's based out of Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm the You and My fan in the equation. My co-host and You and My super fan is the Sydney sider, John O'Duncan, the host of the Progressive Rugby League podcast and general man about town. Jono, how the bloody hell are ya?
Doing good, Tom. You know, when you describe me as a super fan, I don't know if you ever watched the show Super Ted as a kid, but I'm picturing myself kind of in a kind of onesie with a, you know, a big kind of S in the middle of my shirt, but like a teddy bear. Overall, Super Ted, that's what I'm thinking now when you say super fan. So how exciting.
Yeah, I remember Super Ted well. And it's one of those where I've tried to push on my young bloke as like, oh, here's the good stuff from back in my day. And I didn't really buy into the Super Ted hype. But yeah, if you were going to dress yourself up as a You and My super fan, it would be cool to like, you could just decide which Tim haircut you were going to don for that particular night. You'd have like 8 different kind of options. You got the mod option. You got the long straggly option. You got the kind of, didn't he call it like the Sullivan haircut option where he just, some point in the 90s, he'd wake up hungover and look at himself in the mirror and think, fucking get down the shops. Get yourself a $6 Sullivan. Son, sort yourself out.
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea.
Yeah.
Then at the moment he's got, because he's leading for the hard-ons, so it's really long kind of rock, old rocker hair. It's kind of like, I don't know, Metallica or whatever.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Rocking it. All right, so today in episode 5, we're talking Dress Me Slowly from 2001. Before we get stuck into the record, a quick disclaimer. Myself and Jono are in no way affiliated to UMI. We're just two fans talking music for the love of the game. If you found this show, there's a good chance you're already familiar with a group known as UMI, but if not, listen to their records, go to their shows, send them all your money and love. They bloody deserve it. Jono, you seem like a man who reads the nutritional info when selecting muesli at Woolies. How do you think this disclaimer holds up from a legal perspective?
Oh, I've checked the sugar count, the salt, the you know, the phosphorus. It all looks above board. Well done, Tom.
I've balanced the books. I've cooked the
phosphorus,
books.
I don't know where I got phosphorus from. Do they put phosphorus on the side of cereal packets?
Yeah, maybe back in our day, but not for the little ones these days. They've changed it up. So format for the show, it's pretty straightforward. To kick things off, we'll just talk about a few things about what led up between the recording or the release of the prior record and Dress Me Slowly. Then we'll go through DMS track by track. And then finally, we'll talk about what happened after the album dropped and give our gold, silver, bronze medals for the tunes on the record. So, Jono, this is kind of like the longest up at this point in the band's career, the longest time between drinks. It was like 3 years from number 4 record to 2001. So there was a Tim's first solo in between, right?
That's right. There was Tim's first solo. They also released the live record Saturday Night Round 10 in 99. But yeah, I think 3 years in between drinks is a pretty long time for a band that was kind of like reaching its popular heights. So yeah, interesting times.
And yeah, there was those other records slotted in the mix, and I'm assuming kind of like Owly Daily, they probably had a bit of a crack at America, right? Like a long tour on the back of number 4 record to try and get some juice overseas, I'm guessing.
Yeah, from what I gather, I mean, there was a lot of interview material in that J-Files that we've referenced before where they kind of hint at, you know, a tough time gigging all over the world, America, Europe, and not getting a hell of a lot out of it in terms of commercial success, getting a lot out of it, I guess, from a experience and like all that kind of stuff. But yeah, and I guess that was kind of a tough time for the band, maybe. And I think this whole time, really around between know, from number four record for the next few years is an interesting time for the band. It's probably an uncomfortable time for the band as well. For me personally, the release of Dress Me Slowly was really exciting because it was the first time I was effectively conscious for a UMI album release, being someone who got on board in the months after number four record came out. I remember absolutely buzzing in anticipation around the time it came out. I'd read all the lead up press. I'd been keeping myself posted through all the forums. So the release was at the forefront of my mind for probably months. And I remember buying it on release day from HMV, which is a record store in Macquarie Shopping Centre, where near where I went to uni. And before that fact, I pictured myself buying the record, you know, maybe having an in-depth conversation with a Cute staff member, maybe finding a soulmate, you know, because all this sort of stuff was new to me. So my imagination was going places. But in reality, it was all very low-key. It was functional, transactional, which I guess is how retail transactions should be. But, yeah, I guess on the record itself, Dress Me Slowly. Oh, look, first of all, I'd say welcome Davey Lane. What a wonderful presence he's been over the years, not only on record, but also like a really sturdy, rockin' and positive presence at live gigs too. But on the record itself, Dress Me Slowly, look, I'd probably classify it, and this is tough to say to be honest, but I'd probably classify it as good, not great, or rather, really good, not really great, a bit of a qualifier, because all the songs on the album are at the very least excellent, but there is a sense of maybe seriousness to this record that perhaps inhibits the vibe a fraction, and it kind of talks to what we were kind of hinting at before. And all the kind of usual caveats that I'm probably projecting from things I've read subsequently and all that sort of stuff. However, I don't think it's a secret that it's around this time that the band, and particularly Tim, were feeling pressure from outside sources, I guess the record company, I guess, to write songs that were going to bring a return on the record company's investment. And like I say, maybe I'm projecting, but, you know, I reckon you can hear a slight tinge of that pressure on this album. The pressure to be a contender, I guess. But the good news is there's absolutely no sense of the band selling out on the record. The songs are unmistakably theirs. They're great songs, some absolute pearlers. And there's not a hint of them trying to be something they're not. But there is a sense of being uncomfortable and maybe being under pressure that comes across in some of the choices for the album. Like the album cover, for example, it's super serious. I was just flicking through the booklet just then. In all the pictures, there's one smile in all the sort of photos. And you contrast that with the first four records. It's a bit more playful. It's a bit more lighthearted. It's a bit more
irreverent. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so. And so I don't mind the cover, by the way, but that's kind of my sense. And then there's some of the choices of which songs to spend time on to include on the album, which to, I guess, spend less time on and keep as B-sides. And I guess this is what I hinted at last week. And where maybe I've gone a bit rogue or pathetic. I'll leave that to listen to decide. So I've waxed lyrical about the quality of You and My B-sides in previous eps. But this is the one time, and I think the only time, where I would make an argument that you would have had a better album by swapping out some songs from the album proper for B-sides from those same recording sessions, because the B-sides in these sessions are great. They're UMI at their best, and some of them epitomize kind of what makes them a cut above. But I wonder if, you know, the record company or the producer or maybe even the band were kind of focused on how to make UMI a, you know, a big band instead of saying, okay, what ingredients should we include to make this best record we can? Maybe they said, okay, these guys are good. They're pretty popular. Time to take them to the next step, the next level of popularity. I don't know. And I want to emphasize, if there was any kind of misjudgment, and who am I to say, you know, but if there was, it was only slight, because it's a really good collection of songs. But I do think there is a better record from the ingredients they produced during those sessions. And so maybe at the end of the show, I'll suggest a new track listing for Dress Me Slowly that I believe would take it from really good, perhaps into great territory. And looking forward to sharing that with you, to be honest. I know I'm a bit nervous, but In the meantime, I think we should go through the tracks of the album itself because they're all worth talking about.
Yeah, for sure. I think you just accidentally stumbled upon a better name for this podcast. It should have been "Who Am I to Talk About You Am I?"
Yeah, that's pretty good.
But yeah, no, I agree with that general assessment of the record, and I'll talk about my kind of personal relationship with the album as we go through the tracks. But I guess my takeaway from re-listening a couple times over the last week was that in the first four albums there were moments of like power pop and pop songwriting within the within their albums, but with this record it seems like outside forces, or perhaps within the band, it was like, let's go more like pop rock, capital P, capital R. And I think in some moments they pull it off. But other times, yeah, I guess just because being a great band, you've got like a high watermark that you're comparing, you're comparing to some pretty great records. And so, especially in hindsight, because it sounds like a record that was released in 2001. Which at the time was probably a good thing, helped them perhaps kind of like sound of the moment and all that. But in retrospect, it kind of there's less timelessness with the songs compared to other records. So anyway, let's jump in and I guess we can just weave in a bunch of other stuff as we chat through. But to kick things off, track one, Judge Roy. Jono, how do you judge Judge Roy?
I love how this tune kicks the record off. There's a nice little intro. Here we go, and we're off into, I guess, what is a rock and roll western of sorts. Judge Roy is Judge Roy Bean, a famous kind of mythical figure from late 19th century Texas. I just kind of discovered this. A justice of the peace, you know, keeping the law from the Peco to the Rio Grande, as the song goes. But he was more than that. He was very much a larger-than-life character, among other things. He ran a ramshackle courthouse in his hometown, administering judgments based on vibe as much as the law itself, it seems. And he also had a weird obsession with the British actress Lily Langtry, who named the courthouse in the town after, I think, the Jersey Lily Courthouse in the town of Langtry. Thus the lines in the song, "And sweet Lily Langtry whispered his name through the dust and all the sand." Musically energetic. It sounds great through the speakers. And lyrically, it's, you know, pretty cinematic in some ways. I reckon underrated live song too. Sometimes gets thrown in a set list and it always goes down well. So I reckon it's a great start to the record.
Yeah, great opener. I also did a little kind of deep dive on Roy Bean and... he was like a cowboy criminal in the first part of his life, where, not sure if you read, but he was having like a barroom gunfights, and he actually got sentenced for hanging in LA, and he got sentenced to be hung, and then like as it happened, the lady, he got in an altercation with, he killed some lady's partner, and then that was why he was getting hung, and then he got hung, but then that lady came and saved him, apparently. Oh, so, wow. Yeah, but then he eventually became a judge and started gifting out wacky judgments upon the people before him. So, I love this song, and I guess this is a very nostalgic album for me because I mentioned before on the pod, my kind of real entry to the band was the Convicts record, and then after Convicts I went to the classics. I went to Hi-Fi Way and Ali Daily, thrashed them, and I was kind of just, you know, when you found your sweet spot with your band, you're like, these are the albums I like. I'm just gonna thrash these for the next 10 years and not really do a further deep dive because this is what I like.
It takes a lot of work.
But my buddy Alex, he was always kind of very much a discography type of fella, where he'd seek out the lot of it. And we had a thing where he had an Xbox, and then we originally used to play FIFA with each other, but then we discovered Pro Evolution Soccer, which at the time we believed it was a superior version of FIFA, better gameplay, better graphics. And so I was better at him at Pro Evo and FIFA, if we're being honest, but he was super competitive. So I'd be like, you know, the standard best of three, dominate him, I'd win that. He said best of five, best of 10. And then eventually it sprawled down to best of 100. I was like, well, whoever gets to 100 is buying like five slabs or something. We got to. And so, but anyway, this was the album. This is the CD that we used to listen to again and again. So I've got very fond nostalgic memories of like when we'd start the game, here we go. It would be like our respective teams. I think it was like Barcelona, Real Madrid would line up. But anyway, we both really got into this because it's fun on the background and we fucking sing along like a pair of fairies. And but anyway, I would just second what you say. It's a great uplifting start to the album. And I like how the guitar sounds. So, and it reminds me of the Pro Evo days.
Love the idea of Barcelona and Real walking out to the Bernabeu or something to the sounds of Judge Roy.
Yeah, totally. The commentating was no good on that on Pro Evo, so that got muted, and Timmy and the boys got turned right up.
Love it.
Yeah. So Judge Roy, track one. Moving on to Get Up, track two, which, if I'm not mistaken, was the lead single of the album, right? This is what would have been getting you hyped prior to the release?
Well, I'm pretty sure it was the second single, actually. I think Damage was the first single, which was a bit of a surprise because the hype was that Get Up would be the lead single on the forums, but I'm pretty sure Damage ended up being the first single. But yeah, Get Up, a nice follow-up to Judge Roy. It goes pretty hard. I saw this live the last time I saw UMI play live in, I think it was May 2021. A really well-received rendition from memory. I mentioned this last ep, Tommy, but it's the power of the well-timed F-bomb. And in the album version, the line goes, "I'm all thumbs and toes in the way that it comes and the way that it goes," followed by like an immense kind of rockin' yell, which is hard to recreate live. It's kind of a once-in-a-lifetime yell on Get Up. It's incredible, and I reckon it probably can ruin a throat. So hard to do live. So at the end more, it was, "I'm all thumbs and toes with the way that it comes and the way that it fucking goes." No yelp after that, but it actually probably even improves the transition into the chorus. Mm. So it worked beautifully, and, you know, that was a great gig, incidentally. Gigs during the pandemic years had an extra edge to them, so it was a great atmosphere the band were putting in, as always. The crowd was really appreciative and engaged, which I would say my admittedly limited experience wasn't always the case in Sydney. But, yeah, great tune and a clear single, a clear single tune. Yeah.
Yeah, well, my first re-listen of this record in anticipation of our pod here was the other day where I was walking down to my local thrift shop, and I'm the type of bloke where I consider myself an individual because I only exclusively, like 95% of my wardrobe is thrift shop, op shop, pickups. And so I think that kind of gives my wardrobe a sense of randomness and a kind of mismatched that's kind of what I pride myself on. But I came to the realization when I was walking the other day, I was like, the irony is that I'm wearing clothes picked by someone else. All of them have been selected originally by someone else, but I somehow think by creating like a pastiche of all that kind of non-originality, I'm somehow getting original. So anyway, that's what I was thinking about. But so obviously Judge Roy kicks off the record. That's what I started my walk to. But let me tell you, when track two kicked in, holy shit, got a bit of extra pep in the step. I felt like I was marching to a football game, to like a Green Street hooligan about to go rough up some opposition fans. But no, I was going to go to the thrift shop and buy some more clothes owned by other people. But it's a fucking, it's an obvious single. It's and it kind of is just reminds me of like prior songs often. Yeah, like Good Morning would be another one where it's seeming like they've kind of got that euphoric, uplifting start of an album, let's kick shit off song down pat. And yeah, there's a really cool bass line, particularly towards the outro that was always kind of buried. And because I was listening to it closely, I noticed that. And I really liked the lyric, "He don't care about your band." Because then it got me thinking that with guys in bands, if you're in a successful band, you don't need to tell people that you're in a band. If you're in a successful band that people like, they'll tell you about your band. But the other way around is that, like, if you're ever talking about your band to someone, especially a barkeep, like a guy or a gal who's paid to stand there and listen to you, that you probably shouldn't be talking about that. You got to be good enough until they talk about you.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
And you've
got to be wary. Sorry. Yeah. You got to be wary when about what information people are volunteering to you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I guess sometimes you got to be your own publicist, but you can't be you can't obviously be your own PR agent. And I guess one thing kind of on a similar topic, just one thing I forgot to mention with Judge Roy is just how interesting like Tim's lyrics are and just kind of the themes or the stories that he chooses to talk about. Like I was like, who the fuck's Judge Roy? And then thought about something else 10 seconds later. I'd never bothered to investigate or really pay attention to the lyrics that closely. And I guess it's rock music. It's meant to be listened to loud, so you can't catch every lyric. And so unless you hear like an acoustic version, you're not going to get everything. But listening to Judge Roy and kind of doing my own deep dive on like, oh, he was this guy from Texas who had his own saloon and then became a judge. I was like, I wonder how many times Tim's had his ear chewed off by the other super fans in the world adorning one of his haircuts from down the year who've been like, oh, yeah, Lily Langtry, bit of a looker. And by the way, Lily Langtry, you know, whenever you hear about someone who was like a 10 in 1920, you look at the photo, it's like, that's a 6.5 in 22. Like, what are we talking about here? Well, it was just because there were like only rich people could be considered starlets or hotties back then. Right. But Langtry wasn't doing it for me. But it got me thinking like Tim being clever, doing an interesting kind of weird story. Just to kind of, I guess, be subversive or not just think about girls, guys at guitars, like go out of his lane a little bit. But I wonder if he's ever regretted that down the years because people have just kind of needled him with too much Judge Roy shit where he's just like, fucking hell, my fault for trying to go off the beaten path. And it's backfired.
Oh, yeah, it's a fine line, isn't it? On the other hand, I was thinking – because I'd never thought about Judge Roy either or the context of that song. And because I wonder if how many other fans know about that context as well, because it makes it more interesting song.
Yeah.
And I guess like if that was part of the, the hype machine in the lead up to the album or upon the release, that kind of like narrative about, you know, interesting characters from, you know, the Southwest or whatever, that could have been and I could have got more people into it. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I think that is the kind of beauty of music in that I'd always thought Judge Roy was about judging someone yourself. It's like being angry for getting judged and then catching yourself judge. And like, here comes the judge in someone else's shoes being yours. I guess learning about this shit doesn't ruin my original interpretation, and maybe there's like some crossover there, I don't know, but I just wondered, the Tim's talking about the barkeep not wanting to hear about his band, and then being in a band, it's the opposite kind of, you get sick of hearing about, at least from certain individuals, at least we do it nicely from a distance, we're talking amongst ourselves about their band, and not trying to put it, you wouldn't even say hi to the guy, buy him a beer when you saw him a few weeks ago at the Hard-On's gig. So we're extra nice guys, but we've got a lot to say.
Exactly. If that conversation started, it may not have stopped. So it's probably lucky that it didn't start. That was a relief for everyone involved. But yeah, so we're at a good start to the album. Judge yeah. Roy, Get Up, cracking start.
Great start. Yeah, I think they work well together. Then transitions into track three, Beautiful Girl. Jono, you're a beautiful girl in a certain light. Tell me.
Thank you.
What are your thoughts about track three?
I love this song. It's a sweet song right from the Hey You right at the beginning. Really evocative lyrics about fledgling love, you know, meeting on grand final day, holding a chewing gum in your fist. But it's more than just a love song. And I'll get to that in a sec. But first, on the grand final day reference, and with the stuff we've mentioned about pressure from the record company about Tim's songwriting, whenever I hear that grand final day reference, I always imagine some record company dude questioning Tim about the reference to grand final day. And I'm picturing an American here. You know, what is grand final day? Do you mean like a Super Bowl? But you know, I'm kind of imagining that they're trying to sort of get him to change that reference to like maybe Super Bowl day or something a bit more appealing. What's grand final day in an American context? But anyway, the song takes you right there. Grand final day, AFL, I'm imagining. You know, barbecue, some of your mates are gone too hard too early. You know, good times all together. But yeah, back to the song itself. It's kind of a love song, but there's also trepidation from a guy who is kind of intimating that he's, as they say, batting overs, you know, just try keeping up with a beautiful girl, as the line goes. And there are other lines that suggest he's gonna be all at sea in trying to make this relationship a goer. And there also may be a companion song from Tim's Ghost Songs Dirty Ron double solo album. And that song's called Wild One. It's truly one of his best. And it's kind of the other side of that feeling that the trepidation has turned to heartbreak in Wild One, which is a song that kind of hints at the inevitability of going out with someone out of your league appearance-wise. how do I put it? There's only one winner in these situations, and it ain't the ugly duckling of the couple.
Mm.
And actually, I remember Tim at a live gig with the Temperance Union, his band at the time on those records. It was at the Opera House. One of my favorite gig memories, actually. And he relayed some advice to the crowd, which was basically along the lines of, if you're going out with someone who's out of your league appearance-wise, great, but know that the likelihood is that at some point they're going to end up with someone just as ridiculously beautiful as they are, and they'll spend the rest of their lives talking about real estate. Now, of course, that was a certain time in Tim's life, you know, after his divorce and all that. And you know, he probably has a different view on things now. But at the very least, there's a morsel of truth in there. And I think there's an even better insight in that anecdote that I just relayed. And that is that ridiculously beautiful people, both men and women, are generally speaking, really boring. And I don't know if it's because things come easier for them and they haven't had to think things through, tricky situations through as much as the rest of us. I don't know. But I'm digressing. Back to the tune. The ending is where I hear the influence of Davy Lane for the first time. A nice little nerdly guitar bit to end the tune, which is the first real Davy moment in my mind. So welcome, Davy.
Yeah, I like this tune. I also noted down the grand final day thing. I like that kind of as a lyric. Just from like a story perspective where blokes are kind of one track mind, the sport, the mates, the beers on the big day. But then you've got someone who comes out of left field and like overshadows that, which, you know, so where you were completely not expecting. So I think it's kind of it's poetic and bloke poetry, which is what I kind of, I double down on. And yeah, everything you said in terms of if you're a Langtree, if you're 6.5 out of 10, find someone else in your range, and live happily ever after. And I guess this on this song, I did feel like it was a little. I've got this seared memory in my brain of it was like one of the first big day outs I went to, and on the main stage early in the day where they were putting like Australian bands before Rammstein and all the big like international acts would play, they had like a terrible 1-2 punch where like Waikiki, that short-lived Sydney band, were playing right before Friends or Rom, and the two main stages were right next to each other, so all the Friends or Rom fans would amass waiting for it, and they'd boo, they'd drown out Waikiki's set with boos, which was disrespectful but also kind of hilarious at the same time. But anyway, in an interview on Channel V, Jay and the Doctor from Friends or Rom were asked about what they thought of their fans' behavior, and they were like, yeah, look, we think they're being dickheads, they shouldn't boo another band when they're playing, but yeah, if I'm being truly honest, I have zero respect for adult contemporary music. And so I thought, in Jay and the Doctor's typical kind of larrikin, honest manner, where it's like, punks don't respect adult contemporary. And in the chorus here, I sense it's in the ballpark of adult contemporary.
Yeah.
In the ballpark. That's what I'm saying. I'm not adjudicating that this is a bullet by any stretch of the imagination. I love
it's
the tune.
It's an adjoining postcode.
Exactly. But there's something about the production. And I had this wacky idea. I was like, because this is kind of the first of a few tracks on this album where you can imagine the very strong country and western influence, and I was like, would this have worked better as a duet? With like a male and female, kind of like a Kenny Rogers and Dolly Parton type of thing, that. And so once I thought that, I kind of couldn't unthink it, where I was like, that probably wasn't going to happen with the stage the band were at in their career, and they were kind of, you know, trying to be whatever the next big thing. But it just got me thinking. I was like, this would be interesting to hear as a duet.
I can see that, actually, especially like with the first verse or two, you know, hey you, and you know, clearly talking to the other character, and get the other character talking back, and that would be quite beautiful.
Anyway, I think perhaps I like the majority of this song. The oyster next to the pearl line is awesome. But perhaps kind of similar to a few tracks off record number 4, where the production lets it down slightly, perhaps. And maybe it's just because like my sweet spot is less poppy than what they were going for at the time. So
Friends of Rom ruined it for you.
Adult contemporary. Yeah, it was never. Maybe that was the genre that I was destined to fall in love with, but the Friends of Boys cock blocked me. So good on you, lads.
Well, the record, you're speaking about production, this record was produced, recorded, and mixed by Cliff Norell, who I think we're talking off air is has a decent sort of wiki kind of rap sheet with working with people like Bruce and REM and stuff like that. So I guess that kind of also talks to what they were going for, and maybe what the record company was like. This guy is he's a hit maker. You know, get this guy. You want to work with this guy. And maybe at times it didn't quite work the way it could have.
Yeah, I think my, appraisal of music from bygone eras has changed recently as well. I've started to think of it as way more disposable in that, most records aren't timeless. Most records, even popular ones, are going to be popular for a couple years, and then very few people, like only the true fans, will re-listen to them. A lot of fans of bands only listen to greatest hits. So when you think about like a band's career, I like it when they take chances and then they have like a poppy period. And if you look at it contextually, you can think, well, yeah, this is where they were at. They'd had 4 records already. They're kind of alt rock darlings and indie heroes, and now it's time to try something bigger. So no hate whatsoever. I guess it is just because we do have the luxury to look back and you compare it against records that are actually Hi-Fi Way and Ellie Daly, I would argue, are pretty much timeless. Yeah. So that's, yeah, that's the issue you're up against. But yeah, I think that, you know, at the time, this is probably what they needed to do, or at least experiment. It seems like with Deliverance, the next record, they moved away from what they were trying to do here. But it probably served a purpose. And I think that, like, a lot of people could be really dismissive and not see the utility of going towards a more pop sound using a pop producer could have actually provided at the time.
Yeah, I totally agree. There's no harm in giving it a crack. And I guess in the 90s and stuff, being mainstream and all that sort of stuff, but before 24/7 communication, this is sort of something I've been thinking about. Before 24/7 communication, mainstream was kind of everywhere, whereas nowadays you need to find the mainstream because we're all kind of like siloed away. The mainstream's still there, but it's not like, you know, all encompassing. And so these days, I don't actually know what I'm saying, but there's no harm in going, shooting for the stars, I guess.
Got no problem. I know what you mean. You need to untangle your own personalized algorithm that's in front of you for your face, which is preventing you from figuring out what most people like. Because what you like is rammed down your throat now. You're encouraged not to get out of it. Whereas in the back when we were kids, it was the other way around. The mainstream was oppressive. So, I know what you mean. And I think, like, moving on to track four, I think this is one, the first single, evidently, and being track four, Damage, where I think, like, you could, this is kind of like an emotional pop song, and I think this one works amazing in terms of the production and everything. So, what are your thoughts?
I think it's a great tune. The first single, a good choice, something different. A ballad is the first single. It's a bit unusual of the time, I guess. But yeah, real quality tune. I wrote down what I think on the head of a matchstick, you know, self-deprecation, cool turns of phrase, all the ingredients for a great track. I would say, though, that I think the sequencing of this track doesn't quite work for me. After the first few tunes, I'm not quite ready to slow down yet. So in my revised track listing later, I'll place it elsewhere. But yeah, an excellent tune is worthy of first single status, I reckon.
I think it's a killer tune. From memory, the music video is pretty funny. It's just them all looking forlawn in the countryside and some slow motion work and just pondering deep thoughts.
Lush rolling hills,
lots of lush stuff. I think I mentioned this to you off air, but there's like an amazing, I might have been in episode one, but there's a live Channel V version they did where it's just the four guys in the band and obviously no strings, like you get the arrangement on the record, but live. And I'm not sure if it was just because it was like recorded on VHS and then like transcribed digitally and then put on YouTube, but it had kind of this warped waltzy sound, which you can kind of hear the waltzy sound with the organ stuff in the recorded version, but live it was fucking amazing. And it was I guess way more country live. I've for my entire life I've had something against Sunday nights. I fucking hate Sunday nights, the most depressing thing in the world. If I was in a fucking a space coma, shot out to Mars, was asleep for 2 years, how long ever it took me to get there, and they woke me up, I swear I could tell if it was a Sunday night because just the vibe. I can't stand Sunday nights. So that's a great line in this one. And
thank God it ain't a Sunday night.
And it's just a kind of and lyrically it seems interesting as well, where it's like, stare at your baby photos, where someone on Song Meanings or Genius was saying that could potentially be like relationship breakdown where she's taken the kid as well, the kids perhaps, but then it could also just be like someone so pitiful. They're kind of like looking at their lovers, like their actual baby photos, like, oh, I want to take care of you. I fucked it up. Yeah. So it's
or it could be like, what have you become? Like looking at their baby photos going, used to be like so innocent, yeah. But now you're, I don't know.
Now you're a Langtree. Now you're 6.5 out of 10. Emotionally speaking. Cool. So yeah, damage is a goodie. Track 5, Doug Sam, Wham Bam. John, what are your thoughts?
Look, another figure from Texas, quoting from Wiki. He is regarded as one of the main figures of the Tex-Mex music scene, mixing American and Mexican influences. With his blend of music, he found success as the hippie counterculture soared in the 70s. Rolling Stone once wrote, again, this is from Wiki, that Lone Star music, at its best, in every form, was religion to Sam. I don't actually know what that means, but it's probably a good thing.
Sounds now, good.
I might be missing something here. I don't think the song's about Doug Sam. There is reference to the song. And there might be other subtexts that I'm missing. But anyway, cool sounding song, goes well on the record with the horns and everything. Very enjoyable live too. I think Davey's really good at filling in for horns live. He's that good a guitarist. So yeah, it goes really well live. But the album track with the horns, I think, works really well as well. And I think it's Jackie Ozarski who comes back from the Ali Daily horn era and works a bit on this this album too. So I think it works well.
Yeah, this this song, I actually have a funny memory from me and you where you played me the cover version. You know when like Adelita did Damage and then
Enfa. This is the Convict Stain, the sort of the bonus disc for Convicts where they did a Live with the Wireless where a whole bunch of guest vocalists played or sung to You and My
classics. Yeah. Yeah. And with this one, it's Enfa from 1200 Techniques. And I'm not sure if I'm kind of outing myself here as someone who kind of just racially profiles musicians. But when he did this, I swear I heard I Was Never One for Bitches, yeah, instead of I Was Never One for Pictures, yeah. And I thought that was – I think we were on a bus trip somewhere, and I thought that was kind of worthy of sharing with you. And you said, well, Tommy, lyrics are open to interpretation, and you kind of just brushed it off. But I could tell – underneath it all, underneath the calm exterior, you were seething. You're like, this bloke, does this bloke know that he's fucking with my favorite band here? Like, it was like on episode 1 where I said Trainspotting from Sound As Ever Sound, the intro sounds a little bit like Footloose. And you're like, yeah, you're pushing it now, buddy. again, the exterior, the outside was like, yay, all fun and games. Good one, Tom. That was really hilarious. The inside is like, if this cunt does this one more time, I'm cutting my mic off.
It's lucky we're not doing one of those like authentic podcasts that we record and put on YouTube where, you know, I'm wearing a bandana and showing my guns to show how authentic we're recording this. And so, glad it's only audio, so you can't see my seething.
Yeah, he's gritting his teeth here. But I fucking love this song. I actually, maybe because we're talking about the Oasis Bros on prior. Number 4 record, but I could actually imagine kind of like the mid-career Oasis, kind of like the Hindu Times, Don't Believe the Truth era Oasis, which is around then, almost kind of like a cover. I could see Oasis covering this song where Liam's doing the verse and then Noel's doing the chorus, a little Gallagher Bros duet. Yeah. But I think it's kind of it's there's kind of like a snarl to the vocal delivery, and I'm a big fan of this tune. I think it's
Lean On Me,
goes beautiful. Hard. Yeah, and once again, I think we kind of see Davey's the way the kind of it's with Davey. I think they're always a rock and roll band, but I think they could really flex their muscles with the rock and the roll together.
Yeah,
because they could kind of the twinning guitars working off each other, Stonesy-esque sounds. So yeah, I think the lead licks on this one are pretty sweet too.
Yeah.
All right. Track six, What You Doing to Me. But yeah, this, I'll just quickly say my piece on this one. It's just this one sounds so much like an Oasis tune from the Hindu times called Little by Little. It just, there's like the intro sounds like it, the outro sounds like it, just the guitar tone, the kind of crescendo in chorus. So yeah, that was, I know that they toured together and, you know, there's only so many chords in rock and roll, but yeah, it just in terms of from a production standpoint, both those records were around this record and the Hindu times were out around the same time. And so, yeah, just got me thinking. It might have been the earlier one, Standing on the Shoulder of Giants, the other Oasis one. But anyway, I just thought that like Oasis were kind of well and truly in the kind of like that pop rock pocket at this point in time. And so, yeah, it seems like the production, they're kind of going in that same area with a lot of these kind of middle tracks on this record.
Yeah. I getcha. Well, What You're Doing to Me, I think upon the release of this album, you and I did a live at the Wireless, live from Luna Park in Sydney. I didn't get tickets to this, but it was a good sounding gig. They played it live on the radio on a Monday night, and I think they played the whole album all the way through. And anyway, I remember Tim saying of this track on that night that the band kind of thought this was the best track on the album. So I kind of, when we're talking about the mindset of the band at that time, I can kind of, you know, see that perspective. It's like a big kind of pop rock song and has a big chorus and things like that. So I can, yeah, it's a good song too. Great starting lyrics. You know, you drive me to drink, but I'm in for the whole trip. Promise you won't go out with a drunk on the road or use your fork to search for the toast. That's a great set of lyrics to start the track. So yeah, good track. I wouldn't say for me that it's the best track on the record, but yeah, a really solid mid album track.
Yeah, it's hard not to think back and kind of think about other bands that were like around the same time. Like, I don't know, maybe there's like a touch of Grinspoon, just a smidge of Grinspoon, half a teaspoon helping in the chorus maybe. But yeah, I think I could imagine them being hyped on this particular song considering the other tracks on the album and like thinking about. Yeah, I've often wondered, like, when bands get asked that question, is it just the one that they're, like, they're not sick of playing? You know, like, the one they just wrote or something? Like, how much thought goes into that? Because, yeah, oftentimes you get, like, very surprising answers, and it's maybe just because it's like, yeah, we just wrote this the other day, and we're excited about it.
Yeah, as you probably know, like, when you get too close to stuff, like, you end up kind of despising stuff, so you're probably right, actually.
Yeah.
What's your favorite, or what was the last thing I did? Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Track seven, Satisfied Mourned.
Look, as a slightly obsessive fan, Tom, when I was at the shops, which I often was in my late teens, early 20s, around this era.
Shoplifting before John O. came good? No,
just walk around. Just walk around the shops.
Laps.
I generally go to all the music stores like Sanity, HMV, and any store that had music, like Maya, Big W, and I would check UMI was stocked there, and if necessary, give it more prominence in the displays of those stores. So I was going to Macquarie Uni at this time in my life, and in between classes, I'd spend a lot of time at Macquarie Centre, the shops, which is just across the road, and I remember going into HMV on my regular foray to ensure that the UMI display was best practice. And I remember them playing Satisfied Mind really loud in that store during one of my forays. And it was great. Riff sounded really good. I also remember seeing them play this live at the Castle Hill Tavern, which I imagine would have been a watering hole Tim frequented during his time living there in his mid to late teens. And that was supported by Even, which is another band I've come to love over the years. The first time I'd really considered them. So probably not, I wouldn't say one of their most memorable gigs from their perspective, but I remember it very well. And Satisfied Mind is part of that story.
Yeah, this is one song for me where I'm going to tell a weird anecdote, but when I was living in London, I was working, the first job I got after I did my Northern European backpacking jaunt and all my money ran out, I went back to London and I got a job as a live-in, I worked as a bartender at this live-in pub. I worked like my first long week and then everyone else went out on the piss and I was exhausted. So I stayed home and watched like Match of the Day with this other guy and who was like a non-musical guy. We watched Match of the Day and then there was like just music videos on afterwards. And we watched this at the time, there was this horrific song called Goodbye Mr. A by the Hoosiers, who were this British band, just a pop band. And kind of like a, it was like a Freddie Mercury-esque Queen type of song. And then in the song, it's just this pop rock song. And then at the end, there's like, whoa, it's like this chant or something at the mouth. I don't remember the specifics. And this guy was like, that's the best part of the song. That should have been in, why did they just do it at the end? Should have been more throughout the whole song instead of like at the end. And, then, and it was just funny hearing a non-musical person nail it. Like this this guy could have been like, he didn't have the vocabulary of Rick Rubin, but he had the Rick Rubin nous to be like, yeah, why the fuck would you bury that part? That was literally the best part. And so for me, when I think about Satisfied Mind, I the bit that I'm fucking always from back in the Pro Evolution Soccer days is when it drops, hey, hey, yours for 10, where it's got that kind of sound dynamic thing going on. And unlike the Hoosiers, they do the trick multiple times in this song where as a song on the whole, it's kind of, just it, I guess like an average You and My song, like, don't hate it, don't love it, but then every time it gives me that, I'm like, yes. It's the, I don't know, just the interplay of the riff and Tim's vocal delivery hits the spot every single time. And
I do like, I think that,
that's the joy of music where it just the trick works every single time. Magic.
I do like that bit, how Davey's sort of lead kind of like weaves within the vocal there. It works really well on Satisfied Mind. Totally.
So yeah, that's Satisfied Mind, track 7. Track 8, Bring Some Sun Back. What do you think?
Good solid tune. Good solid tune. One of my favorite lyrics on the album, where it goes, and I got a thing going with old Jesus Christ. He keeps me up from sleeping straight at night, and I need to tell you something about the baggage. If I could find the language, she walks like a cello in good vibrations, metered and deadly. I can't help but cave in. It's a great track. I reckon a really solid album track. It's one I rarely, you know, when you listen to an album, you only have, you know, maybe 20 minutes instead of the full 45. When I have my 20 minutes with Dress Me Slowly, I'll always listen to Bring Some Sun Back. It's a good solid track, but maybe not one of my favorites, but I feel like it's a good binding track within this album that kind of connects the front and the back.
Yeah, I like this one because I think you get a glimpse into the future with this one, kind of like what you, the songwriting and the, I guess, kind of the sound that you get on Convicts, like where it, the song just launch, it just launches, I don't know how to talk to you, where it just kind of launches. It reminds me of on Convicts where it's like BMX ride and Bandit, and you just, you're in it. Straight away. Yeah. And so I think I personally prefer the kind of scruffier, more punky, quicker production and kind of songwriting that you get on Convicts. But I like this track because I feel it's, kind of what they did with Convicts in a few records time. And you can kind of see the glimpse of where – yeah, it's stripped back in a sense where they're just trying to get to the good stuff as quickly. Get in and get out. It's like a bank robbery of the song, which I think Convicts has.
Do we need a guitar intro for this? Nah.
Straight into it. Gallop like it. Into it. Yeah. So that's track 8. Track 9, Weeds. Jono, take us away.
Oh, yeah. Such an amazing track. Exceptionally honest songwriting you know, chronicling the narrator's own shortcomings and also, I guess, his worries about the state of his most important relationships. You know, he sure looks like your dad if he can still look straight at night. Oof, you know, that hits you right in the gut. And this is also another song. I mentioned this in, I think, our Hourly Daily podcast, where for Who Takes Who Home, I always like to sing the backing vocal. And this is another song where I like to sing the backing vocal during the chorus. You know, the bit where he goes, gonna sweep them all. I like to hit that backing vocal because it's a beauty.
Nice. Babe, can we harmonize later? Not tonight. I'm tired. All right. Yeah, no, I big fan of this. Might be my favorite lyric on the whole album. It was the way she put her hand on her hip, the sparkle in her eye. But you wonder if it's going to be there all the time. Mm. Similar sentiment to keeping up with a beautiful girl stuff. And yeah, just an amazing, it's a country song essentially. And the chord change on the all the time is superb. I like the lyric tats right there on his toes because, folks, let's get real. Is there a bigger red flag than toe tats? I know you don't see toes very often, but if someone whips them out and there's some scribbles on the digits, the lower digits, you've got some problems.
For someone with hairy toes, I kind of take offense to toe tats. I mean, you know, how do you even get there?
Yeah, well, if you got some really nice toe work done and you shave down to get the work done, got some beautiful work done and then the hair grew back, that would just suck. You can show it off at the local pool. Check this out, kids. I'm cool. Also, by the way, I forgot to mention, you were kind of like you know when band street teams are like, yeah, we're going to put posters up, maybe a bit of graffiti here or there, bring your spray cans. You're the most responsible street team member of all time.
I remember reading a story about band street teams, like subsequently, like years later, and I was like, shit, I did that. I used to do that. Kind of at a very low key level and like a kind of pathetic level. But all I'd do was really like bring You Are My to the front of the wires. That's all I do, really, you know, as you go from A to Z.
That's something, mate. That's something. It's better than nothing. Yeah, I always wanted to be – I thought street teams were cool, but I never had the gumption to really pull the trigger and get myself into one. I was just never in the right place at the right time. But then looking back, I was thinking about this the other day. I was like, I'm happy that never happened because it was kind of just like child – labor, like essentially there's got to be they're like, well, how do they get away with it? Like it's you know, you're not allowed to do that. It's free fucking work. So I'm glad I wasn't a fucking child slave. So any bands out there, if you're thinking about doing it, think again. We're on to you. But yeah,
you could frame it as volunteering. You know, that's
potentially, but even kids aren't even allowed to volunteer, right? That's yeah, I don't know. I'm just assuming.
It's not volunteering if you're a kid. It's slave labor. Fair enough.
There's this American comedian I like, Eddie Pepitone, and a couple of his stand-up specials ago, he had this really good point where he's like, whenever you bring up children in your argument, you can get away with anything. If you just start screaming, it's for the children! For the children! The people, like, they just, you automatically win the argument. So you're right. Yeah. I think I'm doing kind of a version of that now. But, I guess my final thought on Weeds is that, the horns and the brass little squawks at the end are beautiful. Oh, the what's his face is Judge Roy's saloon at the end of the night. The band's tired, but they're still squawking a little bit here and there, and fits the vibe perfectly.
I think I remember Tim referencing this, and once again, it's Jackie Orzowski at the fore here, where he asked Jackie to kind of give the vibe of like a drunken Salvation Army band. I think
nice,
and yeah, I think he pulls it off beautifully.
Yeah, it's like Sergeant Pepper's, but in Australia in 2000 after an RSL piss up. So, yes. Works out well. All right, track 10, Gone. Jono, tell me your thoughts.
Yeah, look, probably a song that took me a while to get into, really. Mid-tempo track, I guess, stuck in the middle of the album, or as you Aussie Rules fans might say, the halfback flank of the album. But actually a really interesting song, and one that I've really grown to love. And I guess what's it about? Like a reflective, druggy kind of character who's kind of gone, this has taken me to the edge, but wouldn't swap it. Am I on the right track there, do you reckon?
Yeah, I for 2 minutes when I was doing my little lyric analysis earlier today, the line, "So I flap my tail and give a high-pitched squeak just so they could leave me in between the rocks to sleep," I was like, is he embodying a fucking seagull? I thought he'd gone full Sid Barrett and Pink Floyd here. Like, no, he's singing about being a seagull and just slipped it in. But I think that's the vibe. It's kind of just someone who's down and out. And because you have to remember, me listening to this album 15 years ago, there was, Barcelona needed to try and figure out a way to break down Real's back four here. So my mind was on the job, task at hand, to get to 100 wins so I could win the 5 slabs. But occasionally the certain lyrics, which I think is evident across Tim's body of work, they just jump out of you and then latch onto your brain. But I don't know where the sadness starts, because I'm so happy I could die. It's kind of like when you've the first few times you go up a really high building, you have the Seinfeld talks about this as well. You have the idea, I should jump off this. And I don't know, the first few times that I was like euphorically happy in my life, I was like, I should die now. Like, that was a weird, because I think your brain kind of short circuits itself when it gets so happy. And over time, you hopefully get back to that euphoric place, and how to actually deal with that level of euphoria. I think it's a beautiful line. It kind of is, if I'm being honest, it's kind of like the thing that I like the most in this song. It's just, because it always stuck with me. Yeah, I always remembered that one, which I think, there's so many of those lines with Tim. A lot of songwriters, you've just got like one or two, but with Tim, there's many, and for me, this is one of them. All right. 11, Sugar. Is this about oral sex?
Yeah, I guess so. I'm very naive, Tom. I don't know about these sorts of things, but yes, I would say so. Like, it's a relationship song, I guess. But I think the message is, when things aren't going great, maybe less is more when it comes to the talking things through kind of thing. Sometimes the best approach is to get physical. The good kind of physical. Can we just get it on? Birds do it, bees do it. It's probably wise advice, a little less conversation, more action. But I don't have to reference that, do I? But yeah, a little less. Yeah. You know what I mean? Let's get down to business. Let's not talk. It's not a time for talking.
I had an issue with the phrase "get it on" when I was a kid, because, the infamous really cool T-Rex song, "Get It On," Bang a Gong. Obviously, that was kind of like Mark Bolan was a cool cat, and that was like a turn of phrase that was like sexually suggestive. But then it's like all those people who were cool when that phrase came about, then by the time I was a kid, they were like my parents and my parents. And it's just like the concept of like saying, "Let's get it on." Exactly. So I think, that I've just had a knee-jerk aversion to that phrase throughout my whole life. Tim and the Boys are of a different era. I think, sometimes you just got to get physical and stop all this fucking talking nonsense.
It's like, "Honey, I think we need to talk." "No, I've got different ideas."
"I'm just going to drop right down to my knees to do it." "Do what?" "I'm not going to say it. I'm not going to say get it on."
We're not talking.
We've talked about this. Yeah.
Talking ruins everything.
All right. So I don't have anything else to say on sugar. Are we done with the sugar? That's enough sugar.
Done with sugar.
All right. So track. Aliens. Well, kick a hole in the sky. Yeah. So and yeah, just this is one where it seemed like this one, and I don't recall, but there was a couple other tracks where they'd finished the record, and then like while they were waiting for it to come out, they wrote some tunes, and then they were like, "Oh, we like these new ones, so we'll fling them on."
Yes, I think you're right there, Tom. There's just on the booklet there, it says the record was produced, recorded, and mixed by Cliff Norell, except tracks 3, 6, and 12. So this is one of those, which is recorded by Paul McKercher at Sing Sing Studios in Melbourne.
Yeah. So, and yeah, it's kind of perhaps just the fact that I know that now I'm grasping for it, but this definitely sounds fresher and kind of like it's got a different energy, similar energy to like Get Up or maybe like Judge Roy or something. But yeah, it feels like it was recorded at a different time or space or whatever. And just personally for me, as we get into the tail end of the album here, by this point, I'd beaten my mate Alex like 3 or 4 times. Well, we'd listened to the record. I don't know. We're playing 8-minute games or something. So I'd smashed him 4 times. And so this is always kind of like I was punching the air. But like, yeah, I have 3 more notches. I'm that much closer to the Carden. And so this was like a nice fist pumper for me where I'd be like, yes, and a solid Pro Evolution Soccer sesh in. And a nice way to kind of like get towards the end of the record. Yeah. Jono, what are you thinking?
Yeah, I love this song. This was the third single off this album, actually. And I think, no, I was going to say it's the last single they released on like CD, but I think they released a single of through Deliverance as well. But I remember you referencing this song in the first episode we did, which kind of reminded me how good it was. It kind of helped me rediscover it. It really is a top-notch song, an interesting strum to start us off, you know, walks like a crooked tooth, and then bam, it kind of just lifts off from there. And there's a really good live version from that Luna Park Live at the Wireless I mentioned, which I heard on the recent J-Files. An absolute beauty. And once again, Davey coming to the fore at the end there with a bit of a kick-ass ending to the tune. So I love it.
And again, we're lucky that this is an audio, not a video podcast, but I'm going to compare it to another song and another band. For me, the intro, especially the guitar tone, perhaps they're the same chords, but it sounds a ton like Learn to Fly by the Foo Fighters. Can you hear that? Yeah.
Yeah.
So it occurred to me earlier today where, again,
yeah.
Unsurprising, similar era, probably similar fucking equipment and studio stuff going on. But it's just something that had never occurred to me before. But I think that, I also love this song as well. It's just that the kind of the way that blokes can love the rock music can make blokes sing high notes with each other is perfect. Yeah. It's perfection. Like, it's acceptable to kind of like this is like pop rock perfection, this song. And you can imagine yourself at a gig. It's got the amazing kind of build up and then the chorus explodes and you've got your arm around a friend, beer flying everywhere. Then you're hitting the high notes with each other or you think you're hitting the high notes. And I think, we don't know how to, men don't know how to express ourselves very well with one another. Sometimes you need, a cracking little pop rock song to let it all hang out. So, this one nails it, in my opinion.
Yeah, and just on your kind of references to other bands and stuff, that's totally cool. I see it all, but I should say that all references to sort of you and my contemporaries, my baseline is utter outrage, but at the same time, I see it.
Yeah. Yeah, but no, yeah. And also, yeah, I've it's only rock and roll, man. They're like, there's only so many chords that it really is just kind of like an intellectual exercise. I think they're an incredibly, unique and original band. But it's just the wiki connection thing where you just thought, oh, that sounds a little bit like this, and you kind of just, yeah. If I was an actual musician that understood musical theory, you'd maybe be better at like, oh, that's the same chord sequence or blah, right, blah, blah. Yeah. But yeah, it's just, it's interesting, if nothing else, to, especially when you've listened to a song a million times, you're like, oh, I'd never pick that up. So
yeah.
Anyway. All right. Last track, 13, End of the Line. Jono, take us out.
Once again, a great closing track, and one where you could choose any one of a million great one-liners of Tim's to relay. I love Tim's rhythm guitar here, particularly as it comes across through the first couple of verses, you know, really, really juicing that orange. And in a way, maybe it's a reminder to himself and maybe the band that, hey, you know, this hasn't been the most enjoyable time, but this is how we do it.
Mm.
This is how it's done, you know, like this is how we have a bit of fun. This is how we kick out the jams and it ain't no fucking exam, you know?
Yeah.
Great tune.
Yeah. I think, mentioned before that this album feels like it's gone for like pop rock, capital P, capital R. I think this track, it's gone for pub rock, capital P, yeah, capital R. Like I think it's maybe his best vocal performance on the album. Yeah. And yeah, I'm going to do it again, but it reminds me of Cold Chisel, Barnsey, mm-hmm, kind of just the, intense, really strong, yeah, delivery. And yeah, I guess my final thought would be one of my favorite towns in WA gets a little shout out, North Albany, gets, which is deep, deep south, WA.
His birthday in North Albany. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Last stop before you hit Antarctica. So yeah, nice little WA reference. It'll get
cold there in winter, I'm guessing.
Really fucking cold. Like it doesn't even have to be winter, and it's
yeah, really,
it's freezing. And I went to Tasmania when I was a child. But with Tasmania, yeah, it's last stop to Antarctica, but like Melbourne and I guess everything that's happening in rural Victoria, it's way more populated and not that far away. Albany's in the middle of fucking nowhere, yeah, and it's really cold, and yeah, it's at the bottom of Australia, and but it's a really beautiful place. And nice. I think that if I ever retire in WA, thinking way down the line, I wouldn't mind. If I could deal with the cold, North Albany might get a look in. But
you'll be that guy at the gigs we were talking a couple of episodes ago where there's always, from Tim's book, there's always a guy's like, Perth, yeah, Perth. But yeah, you'll be that guy. Me. You'll be like, North Albany.
Albany. The end of the line.
It's freezing.
Yeah. All right. We did it.
All right. We did. Now, I think this is probably the time, Tommy, for me to get a bit controversial maybe. As I said, I think we can get a better album out of the stuff that I recorded during these sessions. I'll be frank. So what I've done is I've broken it down a bit. I've made it into like a kind of record, a two-sided record, which is kind of, I feel like a bit of a fraud because I don't actually have a record to play. But anyway, I think it just works better from this perspective. So
yeah,
we'll go through it, and then at the end we'll kind of like assess the ones that I've dropped and the ones that I've included. So this is the track listing. Side one. I'm going to start off with a B-side called She Don't Need the Morning. And this is a B-side from Damage, a Damage B-side, the single. I sleep as sound as a train crash and wake like I got out of jail. I love this song in and of itself, but I reckon that's such a great line to start an album with. And plus the song resonates with me because I think like Tim, I'm a pretty rubbish sleeper a lot of the time. And this song perfectly encapsulates the travails of a rubbish sleeper. You know, my personal issue is I can't sleep past sunrise, and that's fine if you go to bed at a decent hour. But when I don't really have the ability to let the morning ride. I need the morning. My girlfriend, on the other hand, is a good sleeper. If she goes to bed late, she could sleep long into the morning. But, you know, as the song goes, she don't need the morning like I do. Maybe it's an anxiety thing. I need to get ready to face the world. I need the time. I don't know, but I love the song. Very interesting subject matter. Nice sounding rhythm guitar. There's an interesting little change up before the solo, and then Davey brings it home really nicely. So it's, I reckon it's a great song to start an album with and would work really well as an opening track on this revised Dress Me Slowly disc. Okay, so that's the first track. Then I go into Get Up, which we want as the second track. Beautiful Girl, I'm keeping in there. Doug Sam. So I'm moving Damage out because, as I said before, I feel like I'm not ready to slow down at that point. So straight into Doug Sam, Bring Some Sun Back, slowing it down a bit with Gone, 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 and then the last track on side one, Damage. So okay. I'm finishing this this side with Damage, so we can kind of like, you know, regather ourselves and get ready for, you know, the second half in pro Evo soccer terms. Let's say. Then side two, I'm kicking that off with Judge Roy. So it's a great opening track. We'll talk about how much we loved it. I reckon this would be a great way to kick off side two and kick off the second half of the album, to get us back into the groove, back into the spirit of things. Then I'm going for two B-sides in a row. First one, Tourism from the Get Up B-side, and then the third one, Older Guys, another Get Up B-side. So Tourism is a great tune. It's from the Rogers childhood / teen anecdote canon. I don't know if Tim spent too long writing this one, but that's okay. There are some great lines in there, and it does transport you to the time and the environment. You know, lick off the greasy spoon. They're the first words. And the chorus is cool too. You know, we learn everything from Mad Magazine, an A-grade education from a pinball machine. You crawl down the road just to get off the rack. Didn't want me to come, get your hand off my back. It's, I don't know, it's a cool song. And then Older Guys, for anyone who's spent a heap of time with and learnt from older siblings or cousins or friends or your folks or whatever, older dudes at school, this song really, like, you know, will ring some bells. And like Tourism, they're both like pretty relaxed musically and very kind of enjoyable listens. So side two started Judge Roy, Tourism, Older Guys, into Weeds, one of our favorite songs from Dress Me Slowly, into another B-side called 1 Cent Coins. This is from Damage. This is a pretty rockin' tune that really builds up to a cool crescendo. I like the vocal tone. There's some nice drumming touches by Rusty near the end there. Just a tune with balls and some great one-liners there, as usual, as well. And then we finish off with Kick a Hole in the Sky and End of the Line. Now, I don't know what you think about that, but I want to note, firstly, before I get to your thoughts, that Open All Night came close to being included. So this is a tune, I think, from, yeah, it's a Damage B-side. It was from the Better Than Sex soundtrack. It has a raunchy film clip. But in the end, I thought that Dress Me Slowly already had a cracking closer in End of the Line, so I didn't include it. And I also didn't include Be Prepared, a great sort of Get Up B-side, or any songs from the thoroughly excellent solo bonus disc that came with the first edition of Dress Me Slowly, including possibly the most poignant song Tim's ever written called Paragon Cafe, which I visited the other week, incidentally. So I consider these songs Tim's solo tunes rather than You Are My Tune, so I didn't consider any of those songs, as good as they are, for the alternative track listing. So there's my alternative track listing. I think overall it's a slightly superior track listing to the one that came out. I've sort of deleted, and with, you know, with a heavy heart, of course, I've deleted What You're Doing to Me, I've deleted Satisfied Mind, and I've deleted Sugar, and I've included She Don't Need the Morning, Tourism, Older Guys, and 1 Cent Coins. So it goes to a 14 track record.
You didn't kick off any of my faves, so I sign off on it. And the sequencing sounds good to me. I like the Judge Roy kicking off side two, and the ending remaining the same. Kick a hole in the sky, End of the Line. And I guess I'm guessing here, because I haven't heard these B-sides, but it's just the general tone that, like, they went, those ones are kind of like more rockier, more raucous, and the ones that ended up on the album are kind of like more, I don't know,
a bit more polished. Yeah,
polished, low key, or like, well, why do you think those ended up as B-sides versus like the ones that made the record? Like, what were they going for with the weaker songs on this album? Do you feel like compared to the B-sides?
I think they're a bit more relaxed musically, I think, and so I don't know, that they feel a bit looser, and I think also some of the ingredients that make You and I sort of a cut above just your normal rock band is, you know, I guess a big component is Tim's songwriting, I guess his point of view as well, how the way he sees the world. And I guess in some of these songs, you know, She Don't Need the Morning, I think that's a unique perspective of someone who has trouble sleeping. Tourism is a great kind of childhood memory tune, which he's so good at. Older Guys as well is another, you know, not necessarily unique, but just an interesting angle. And then 1 Cent Coin is probably, out of those four, is kind of a really rocking tune. The others are kind of have rocking moments, and Tourism sort of is kind of a pretty rocking song and rolls not quite nicely. But yeah, I think it's more like the vibe, and overall, as I mentioned at the top, that the album proper has a tinge of seriousness to it. So I think this kind of loosens it up a bit, yeah, overall.
You mentioned before that when you've been in public situations, you're at a party or something, and like whether you have the balls to put on UMI, you have to kind of pick your spots. So I want you to, the kind of the final form of John O'Duncan is you not only not being afraid to put it on a UMI record, but like putting on your remixed version of the album. That's, you're like, check this out. I'm like, when did this come out? This sounds like it was from early 2000. Well, actually, it's something that I cooked up the other week myself.
I can imagine that kind of conversation. Yeah. I'd be escorted from the building, I think.
Yeah, totally. That feels like a peep show episode or something where, yeah, you're just offending other party girls or freaking them out. But, Now, anyway, I think that's before we get into our podium, the gold, silver, and bronze tunes from the record, what have we got to say about what happened? Because after the release of the record, I guess notably that this ruined their run of consecutive number ones, where this one charted at number three. And it seemed kind of like their little purple patch there, at least commercially, was over. But then like Davey Lane was in the band, and I've seen a few live performances from around this time on YouTube. I think there's one in Brisbane at the Tivoli. Is that how you pronounce it? There was, and I sensed that there was kind of like an acceptance to be like, well, we're an Australian band, we're going to do Australian tours, and kind of just like getting into that again, as opposed to being like, oh, we've got to crack America or go to the UK or something. So it seems like that it's interesting, like going back through UMI's trajectory, because like, you oftentimes see them play at similar sized venues in Australia, but like at very different phases of their career, which is kind of rare, because a lot of bands, like, they start small and then go big and then die, or but UMI, they've played lots of the same venues, so yeah, it's interesting to look at. But what are your thoughts in terms of like the reception and what happened with Davey and the band from a live perspective?
Yeah, I think, you know, just to your point there, I think they've kept on keeping on, which is just a huge respect for that, where, like, you're right, a lot of bands that come and go and rise and fall, and these guys have kept going and kept fighting the good fight. I would say, yeah, I think if you look at most bands, pretty much every band, there is a popularity peak that lasts a few years, and then, you know, it dwindles from there. So, like, the trajectory of UMI is not unusual at all. It's actually very, very unusual to be, to be popular for a long stretch to sort of maintain popularity. And so, but in saying that, it doesn't mean that wouldn't have been kind of jarring and frustrating and, yeah, I guess annoying through that period for Tim and the band. Because I imagine in the preceding, you know, 5-10 years, people were talking them up so much, saying, you know, next big thing and, you know, best band in the world kind of thing. You know, they're going to love you in America and in the UK and stuff. So that would have been built up. And so the kind of commencement of the decline of their popularity, while, you know, from an outsider's point of view, is kind of totally predictable. From the inside, it would have been, it probably would have hurt, I'm guessing. You know, as, because also this was the time, wasn't this the time of like the rock revival and stuff? So while that's happening, you know, you might have thought, you know, this might be Yilmaz's time to kind of, you know, really take that next step. But that they were in their kind of inevitable kind of, you know, slight gradual decline in popularity, while other bands that really were kind of, you know, not impersonating, but had to give thanks to UMI for, you know, breaking down the barriers and sort of giving them some of their chops. They were starting to sort of explode a bit. But, of course, they've subsequently petered out while UMI continue on. So, in hindsight, it kind of all worked out well that it kind of gradually settled into a sustainable and something that could work in the long term, whereas if the popularity continued for a bit longer, it probably would have just burst and ended. So kind of that's how I look at that period, and just with reading some stuff and sort of understanding that the pressures that they were feeling, it would have been hard, but I think from an outsider's perspective, it kind of, and in hindsight, kind of seems inevitable.
Yeah, the way I see it is that UMI, they've always made UMI records. Like, this is maybe kind of like a poppier version of some other, but it's still fundamentally, they've never completely sold their soul to, like, just try and jump on a trend or whatever. And so when I think about the band's career, like, if you'd been a fan that had been around since Sound As Ever, you've been following the band for, like, 6, 7, 8 years at this point, like, and just people would have been like, their life cycle, that fan is kind of like maybe getting married, like having kids at that point. So if you're talking to that fan, maybe you've got that fan for life, but they're not coming out to gigs anymore. And so that the band has to make a choice, is like, do I keep those fans with like the dwindling returns because they're not going to, you know, be as dedicated as they once were when they were young and carefree, or do I get some frosted tips and try and appeal to the next batch of uni kids who are coming up? And so I think that UMI, the reason for their longevity is that they seemed kind of like, and it's probably got something to do with like Roger's songwriting, is that I think they were, even if they wanted to, they're probably always going to be incapable of like changing who they were as a band too much. And I think that's kind of, it probably hurt them at this point if their immediate goal was to try and have another number one record and be the, you know, poster kids of Australian rock for in terms of longevity, as you mentioned, I think it's helped them out because they've always made UMI sounding records, and so the fans that have got on board have stayed on for the long haul.
And to your point about playing the similar venues for 20 years, I guess in a lot of ways that's a fantastic achievement to, because to do that you need to kind of replenish the stocks a little bit, like in terms of your fan base, and I do notice that as I keep going to gigs, like so the gig I mentioned last year, 2021, was a sold out and more theatre gig, which is no mean feat, and the kind of makeup of the crowd, well, yeah, it is kind of that generation that grew up with UMI, but it's also, you know, quite a few younger people, so it's staying true to what they know and what they love, and particularly Tim's unique style of songwriting, I think has worked well in the end to help them be, you know, to help them be sustainable, I guess. And yeah, so I think that's kind of worked out in their favor in the end.
Mm. Yeah, but it's also just
would have been a tough transition to sort of live through it, I imagine.
Yeah, also maybe something I've always wondered about Australian artists in that, you know, at the time, population would have been like around 20 million in Australia. Yeah. It's not like a big country. It's a huge, you know, and the difficulty of touring is just like huge landmass, but with not much population. So, you know, in America, if you're a band that's popular in America but not overseas, you conceivably could tour way more and make way more money. So I think, that's almost like a testament to their achievement there, is that they've, by the nature, they've had to play the same capital cities again and again and again. And people still coming out. So pretty impressive.
Yeah. And I guess one more thing on the popularity thing, I guess from their contemporaries in the 90s, you know, obviously You and My were popular for a couple of years, and then like Powderfinger kind of exploded and became like just a juggernaut of popularity. Though it was just kind of, to think now, kind of mind-boggling about how popular they were. And so while they were contemporaries at that time, then in terms of popularity, Powderfinger just shoots up, and then You and My starts like an inevitable kind of decline in their popularity. And then a couple of years later, you know, other bands like Jet and the Vines kind of explode in popularity, so that all of a sudden they may have kind of started feeling kind of like the forgotten soldiers, I guess. But what do you do?
Yeah, well, that interview you share with me when we were emailing this week, where Rusty was like, "Yeah, we're going to go to America, but like statistically, it won't work, and so we're just going to go have a good time." And so it seems like, like Tim has admitted like that, the pressure got to him at certain points. And like you said, I think it would probably be jarring going from the top to like second rung on the ladder. But in retrospect, I think what can you do? It's just that you can't help when you're born and when you first break onto the scene and all that. So all right. Gold, silver, bronze time. What are you thinking?
Oh, this is a tricky one. Okay, I'm gonna go. I'll start with my bronze. I'll go Kick a Hole in the Sky. Mm-hmm. Like I said, just a cracking track and almost perfection, really, in that tune. It's such a good song. So many elements to it. I would say number two, I'll go Judge Roy. This is a track that, probably understanding the context of it probably adds to its mystique and adds to the impact for me listening to it the last couple of weeks. So really sort of got on board with Judge Roy. And then number one, Weeds. I think that is a track that I just can never skip over. I just need to sort of soak it in every single time. So I love it so much. So, Kick a Hole in the Sky, Judge Roy, and Weeds. How about you?
So for me, I'm going bronze. Dougie Sam gets on the podium with a bronze. Silver, Weeds, man, gets the silver. And the gold for me is Damage.
Oh, yeah, right.
Nice. Yeah, made its way to the top. So, that's it. I think we did it.
Yeah, interesting period.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Davey's in the band now, and there's only 1 year between this record and the next episode. We'll be doing Deliverance from 2002, and I guess it's a weird timeline here because we're recording these in the past, but by this point the episodes will be out. There'll be ways for you to get in touch via email. I'm going to try and figure out a voice messaging thing. So if you listen to this episode, you want to criticize me for my bad comparisons of songs to other UMI, if you want to get in touch with Jono and represent him for doing unpaid child street team shit in the.
You want to start up a new street team gang? We can.
Yeah, just get in touch. Yep. But anyway, thanks for listening, and stay tuned. Till next time.
Peace. See ya.